Hi there again, my name's Todd Fraser and it's my pleasure to bring you another special edition of the Essential Critical Care Podcasts from the 20th Annual ANZIC C2G meeting from the beautiful Noosa Heads in Queensland, Australia. Joining us on this episode is Manoj Saxena, who's going to talk about temperature control in traumatic brain injury. Manoj, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So many people would accept the concept of hypothermia being bad for brain injuries, but let's go back to the pathophysiology. Why does high temperatures impact in brain injury?
Yeah, so look, most of the data that we have that answers this question comes from animal models of disease. And there have been a number of animal models done over the last 30 to 40 years that have suggested that this hypothesis might be true, that fever is bad for the brain, and also that reducing temperature, so induced cooling, might mitigate or prevent that damage. So a lot of the work's come from ischemic stroke animal models. And then perhaps over the last 10, 15 years, there's been some animal models of traumatic head injury that have also contributed. And the signal appears to be quite strong, particularly if you get in before the injury occurs in animal models.
Yep.
If you start the intervention of induced cooling during the injury, or even after. But obviously the strongest effect comes from getting in before. And the effect's been measured in terms of histopathological damage and also then neurobehavioral outcomes, so kind of how animals perform on maze tests, etc. And there seems to be a fairly strong signal, even after injury, of getting in with induced cooling, that there's a benefit on those endpoints, histopathology and neurobehavioral outcomes.
Do we know what the pathological mechanism is? Is it just an oxygen consumption issue, or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, look, I think the mechanism... Look, I'm not a basic scientist, but I've read a lot of the papers. The mechanism seems to be to do with reducing metabolic rate, I think, as one thing. And therefore, if you reduce metabolic rate, you're reducing the delivery, the need for oxygen and, you know, glucose, etc. Also reducing swelling. I think there's definitely an effect on reducing swelling because the brain's within a confined space. And I think that also improves perfusion because you're allowing more more blood flow, if you like. There are hypotheses around free radicals and, you know, cytokine modulation with induced cooling, changing the balance of pro- and anti-inflammatory cytokines. But I think it's really difficult to pin it down to one specific thing. I think of it as reducing metabolic rate, reducing swelling, and maybe improving blood flow with induced cooling as kind of gross mechanisms. But what's going on at the cellular level is difficult to disentangle.
So how much can you glean from the large body of work that's occurred in non-traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, so there's a lot more data in non-traumatic brain injury. So there's a lot of work in ischemic stroke. That's probably the best model that's been studied. And these tend to be models where you either occlude the whole carotid artery, or you have, so you've got a large hemispheric infarction, or if you've got smaller sub areas of infarction. And sorry, your question was around how much can we glean from it?
Yeah.
And look, there's some lovely work. So Malcolm McLeod and a group in Edinburgh have done systematic reviews of animal models of disease. And one of the ones that they did was on all the animal models of hypothermia and ischemic stroke. And they showed quite nicely that when you look at the 110 reasonable quality studies from animal models, there seems to be a better effect the lower you go in terms of temperature, certainly the quicker you get there, and that there is definitely an effect after injury, do you know, within a time frame of what would be reasonable clinically, do you know, getting in between, I can't remember exactly, but up to 6 to 8 hours after injury, there's still a biological effect that could be could suggest that healing could occur in human models. Yeah.
So in some of the other pathologies, we've moved away from the concept of induced hypothermia and looking more at an emphasis on avoiding hyperthermia. Is that the crux of your suggested trial?
Yeah. So look, I've been working, so my PhD and working with others in this area roughly for about 10 years. And over that time, the focus really has been on hypothermia, induced hypothermia. Yeah. And we have now a large number of studies in traumatic head injury looking at that question, both for early preemptive hypothermia, but also as a reaction to raised intracranial pressure. And the signal appears to be from a lot of those studies that rather than benefit, there may be harm. And I think, you know, the POLAR study, which will come out later this year, is probably the best designed study to date. It's going to give us an important answer because it's getting in with very early hypothermia. It may be, if there is a benefit, we might see it in that study. But I think most of the studies to date perhaps suggest that induced hypothermia may not be beneficial, may be associated with harm. And I think one of the problems is we've never had a really good biological monitor of what hypothermia is doing to the brain.
Right.
You know, we've never been able to get into the brain and measure oxygenation or brain temperature, you know, markers. We've chosen targets for temperature management based on the animal models, and we've gone for 33 when maybe 34, 35, 36 might be better. We don't know. It's exciting now that we do have technology coming that might allow us to titrate the dose of cooling to neurobiology, but they're not, you know, they're mainly research practice interventions at the moment. We're beginning to use them in our hospital to try and understand the effect of induced cooling on neurobiology, but it's early days with that, yeah.
Just quickly, what are some of those technologies that you're referring to?
Yeah, so one of the so apart from intracranial pressure monitoring, there's LICOX, a LICOX device, which gives you information also via a similar, can be put in through the same ICP monitor hole, but it gives you information about tissue brain oxygen and also brain temperature. So they're two important parameters. And then the other device that we're using is cerebral microdialysis, and that gives you information about glucose, lactate, pyruvate, glycerol. So markers of cellular health. So you could imagine it might be possible to induce cooling, if that was the intervention, or give an osmotic diuretic and then measure changes, highly specific in one region of the brain, to see whether you're influencing either oxygenation or cellular health. And that's very exciting. But yeah, just being introduced into, I think, research practice at certain centres around the world.
So the study that you're doing is looking at normothermia, presumably to attempt to avoid the consequences of hypothermia. What are those consequences?
Yeah. So with hypothermia, the main complications that concern people are that in order to deliver the therapy, you need deep sedation, sometimes paralysis to avoid shivering. So you end up prolonging length of stay, and then there are all of those complications that you get as a consequence of a longer ICU stay, and often that's acquired infection or DVTs and PEs. So those kinds of effects. And then also there's this concern that we're taking temperature down, you know, quite substantially, 4 degrees, you know, from the normal range, and we don't really know what we're doing to parameters like blood flow. Autoregulation might be quite impaired. There's a possibility that we may be making the brain more ischemic, you know, if we're getting the dose wrong, you know. So it may be that a more modest way of changing temperature. And you've got to think, I often think that changing temperature by 4 degrees Celsius is like changing your blood pressure by 40, 50 millimeters of mercury. It's a massive change, but we used to thinking about it, because that's the therapy that we've been investigating for so long. But it's a huge change, and maybe a more gentle change. Just avoiding fever may avoid some of those adverse effects, but also give you the benefit that has been described in the animal models.
So you're still in the process of working up to this trial, I understand, but what are you proposing to do in this study?
Yeah, so look, it builds on a lot of previous work we've done in Australia and New Zealand. So we've done a bunch of studies that have just tried to describe what is standard practice in Australia and New Zealand. And one of the things we've found is that actually hypothermia is rarely used, but fever is fairly common. And it depends how you define fever as whether for someone with a brain injury, we lack a consensus definition, but whether you say that fever for someone with a brain injury is above 38 or 37.5, depends on what you think fever is as to how common it is. But regardless of the definition, it's common in Australia. Mm. And our standard practice approach seems to be to add paracetamol at around 37.5 degrees Celsius and then add physical cooling once temperature is above 38. And sometimes that's driven, you know, about in a quarter of cases by raised ICP. So we've described standard practice and we're comfortable that normal Australian practice is incremental addition of treatments to try and keep temperature below 38. So we've done that. We've also done a little bit of work that's suggested that paracetamol at best has a modest effect on temperature, maybe less than half a degree, if at most. And then the last thing we've done is a feasibility study of strictly avoiding temperature versus what I've described just now as standard care. So we've recruited 45 out of 50 patients into the feasibility study. It'll end at the end of March this year, so just in a few days. And we'll learn whether a protocolized approach to strictly avoiding fever achieves separation between that and standard care. Based on those results and the POLAR study, and also, you know, we just talked about that mechanistic, the understanding the neurobiology of changing temperature. Well, within our feasibility study, we'll have data on the two temperature targets, so strict normothermia versus standard care, and the effect on neuronal biology. So we'll have a lot of information from which to plan a large clinical trial, and I'm hoping that we'll be in the situation in about 6 months to a year from now where we could put a big grant together to fund a study which would roughly be around 2,000 patients. So it would need all Australian sites plus some international sites, and we'd be able to answer the question of whether controlling fever after traumatic brain injury reduces death and disability.
Are there enough of these patients to go around? Because there seems to be 100 different trials that are looking at brain injury at the moment in Australia.
Yeah, this is a great question, Todd. And I think as a community, what we're doing is we're actively engaged in having a dialogue about what's the next best question for traumatic brain injury and where should we put our resources. One of the other studies our group's considering, the CTG group, is a study by Andrew Adi on PbO2, so tissue oxygen in the brain directed therapy for TBI, and we're considering that too. I think as a group we're a very collegiate community, and I think we'll make the best choice based on what data we have in the next 6 months to a year. It could be either study, and maybe it's possible to harmonize. We're also looking at putting studies together to add additional value, so maybe we could do a temperature control study with PbO2 monitoring.
So the study that you're looking at is effectively standardised care, which is an incremental approach based on the research that you've done, versus a more proactive approach to maintaining normotherapy, is that correct?
Yeah. So the intervention arm in the study that we're testing in the feasibility study is to maintain a temperature of 36 for 72 hours after presentation to the ICU. Yep. So we know from the data that we've got previously that most patients come in with a temperature of less than 36, and they tend to get towards 37 in the first 24 hours. So our aim in the intervention arm is to clamp them at 36 degrees Celsius during that period where you're actively sedating, brain resting the patient. So we've got temperature of 36 for that period of time. for the first 72 hours.
Is it a challenge to maintain that separation? And I know you haven't, or that's the purpose of your feasibility study, but do you do that by randomising institutions to prevent people drifting towards the, you know, the intervention arm, as it were?
So the feasibility study, you're quite right, will give us that data. But from our observation at the three sites, it seems, and our historical audit data, you know, it seems like we'll get reasonable separation of about, you know, a degree and a half to 2 degrees, which is a large, like I was saying before, if you think of blood pressure or glycemic control, that's a huge change in the biological range, you know, for temperature.
And for those who don't come to this conference, tell us about what you expect to get when you present this to the group. How does this meeting influence the design of your study and getting it to come alive?
Yeah, that's so. The meetings, it's a fantastic opportunity for anyone with an idea to come and bring it to the group. The feedback you get is always constructive. It's a robust discussion, and I think that can appear intimidating, but it's actually not intended to be that way. It's actually the robustness of the discussion is an important part of getting to the best truth for that question or that study design and finding the best pathway. It's a really good forum, and I'd encourage people, even if you're not coming with an idea, just to come to hear what the current research questions are, hear the pros and cons of doing things certain ways, and it's excellent continuing medical education as well as, you know, research education as well. So the things I take away from the group are really, you know, it's you get a sense of whether there is interest in the research question, and you also get your idea optimized, you know, by getting the expert input.
Manoush, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks, Todd. Okay.
Thanks for joining me again on this episode of the ANZIC CTG Noosa Meetings podcasts. For more episodes, please check out my blog at essentialcriticalcare.com or search for Essential Critical Care on iTunes.